So there's some interesting research that shows that we already know that perfectionists tend to just keep raising the bar. You know that thing you do where you go like, oh, I did, you know, that was good. That was good. But, you know, I did a good job and it was hard. But, you know, anyone could have done that. Next time I'm going to do like even better. So that sort of tendency to sort of dismiss your achievements and raise the bar for next time leaves you feeling like you're constantly, that success is out of reach constantly. And that's something you're doing to yourself as a perfectionist.
That was Jennifer Kemp, and this is Mentally Flexible. Welcome to Mentally Flexible, where we have meaningful conversations to help you build mental flexibility. I'm Tom Parks. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and in each episode, I'll be talking to people who inspire me most on topics related to psychology, mental health, and creativity. My hope is that through these conversations, you'll better understand yourself, others, and the world around you. Thanks for being here, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. My guest today is Jennifer Kemp. Jennifer is a clinical psychologist in private practice in Adelaide, Australia. She works with adults and adolescents on issues such as perfectionism, anxiety, OCD, eating disorders, and chronic illness. Jennifer uses acceptance and commitment therapy to help people notice their experiences, make conscious choices in the moment, and move towards a fulfilling life. Some of the topics we explore include how Jennifer's own story informs her new book, The ACT Workbook for Perfectionism, the underlying processes of perfectionism and how metaphor can be used to understand them, the role of self-compassion, how exposure techniques can develop greater flexibility, the intersection of perfectionism and OCD, and we end by exploring the impact of perfectionism on relationships and our professional lives. I really enjoyed talking to Jennifer about this important topic that many of us struggle with, myself included. And what better episode for my mic to not have worked properly? So apologies in advance for my audio not being as clear as usual during the interview. What better episode for me to practice making space for imperfection, right? And thank you all for being here and your continued support with the show. I know it's been a while since the last episode. Life is very full and dynamic for me right now, but I am committed to this podcast. I just can't commit to any regular frequency and appreciate you still being here. Okay, well, without any further delay, let's get into the episode with Jennifer Kemp.
Well, thank you again for doing this.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. I'm really looking forward to it. I love your podcast. And I think I'm looking forward to having a good chat today.
Yeah, me too. This is an important topic for me personally, honestly. Uh-huh. So I'm looking forward to getting to hear your thoughts. And I started reading your book and it's great. And I'm really looking forward to this.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, I can talk for hours on this topic. So you're going to have to just, just ask away whatever you want to talk about. I'm cool. I'm cool with that. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the book, you talked about this being something personal for you too, that informs a lot of the work that you did on this topic.
Yeah, absolutely. I realized in sort of my early 30s that I've been struggling with perfectionism. It took that long to put the pieces together. It took some going to a workshop, with Professor Tracy Wade here in Adelaide, and she was playing this song as we walked in called like Never Good Enough. I listened to it again recently and it's still like, oh, you know, got me in the heart. And I just started like crying basically as I'm walking in the door trying to be professional. My eyes just completely filled with tears. I thought that's something to pay attention to. And all across the day, she just went through how perfectionism is related as a transdiagnostic process. So it's like related to as a risk factor and a maintaining factor in a whole bunch of different mental health problems and personal problems people have. And she didn't even cover them all. Like, I've since uncovered even more that aren't in her research. But and I just started joining the dots. You know, I'd had anxiety, I'd had a major depressive episode. When I was in my teens and early 20s, I had an eating disorder. And all of these things are really related to perfectionism. So it sort of, I wrote all these notes and I went back to my therapist and said, here, you know, this is what I need to work on. No one had picked it up in all those years. Mm. I'd had therapy for eating disorders. You know, maybe they thought that they sort of saw it as part of my personality, so something that couldn't change. But I really strongly believe that it is something you can change. And there's been, you know, other people have been talking about this too. There's CBT, some of the CBT guys have been doing, or girls have been doing, like some really good research on using CBT for perfectionism. And I do it a bit differently. I use ACT, but there's a lot of parallels in our approach. So, and they've had some really good results. It's been really good to see. I'd like to see more research from an ACT perspective. So in my personal journey, I think it started there, really, with this in a way. Mm. Like, I mean, it started when I was born, but in terms of trying to change it in myself, I guess I started there. So that was about 12 years ago now.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how would you describe that process of perfectionism? Like, I mean, it seems pretty obvious in that word, but underneath it, like, what does that process look like that's common in all these different mental health challenges people can experience?
Yeah. So I tend to look at it from a process perspective. So I look at it as sort of five processes. It's a little bit like, they're similar to the processes you'll see in OCD, and there's a lot of overlap in the way I would conceptualize perfectionism as well. So it starts with almost like that obsession. So these are the really, really high standards that you end up setting for yourself, and they can be quite obsessional, like that shift from I want to do well at school to I need to get an A on every single assignment, no matter how little it's worth. Is getting very rigid. And so there's nothing wrong with having high standards. I'm sure if you're a fellow traveler on this journey, you'd relate, you know, well, don't try and take away my high standards. I want to do good work. But when they become really rigid, that's the problem. You know, they become a rule that you have to follow. And when you keep raising them all the time. So there's some interesting research that shows that we already know that perfectionists tend to just keep raising the bar. You know that thing you do where you go like, oh, I did, you know, that was good. That was good. But, you know, I did a good job and it was hard. But, you know, anyone could have done that. Next time I'm going to do like even better. So that sort of tendency to sort of dismiss your achievements and raise the bar for next time leaves you feeling like you're constantly, that success is out of reach constantly. And that's something you're doing to yourself as a perfectionist. Then the second process is really being scared of failing. So this is where in ACT, I think, you know, a lot of your listeners are pretty familiar with ACT. Is that right? So, yeah. So we can talk about experiential avoidance. This is like, no one wants to fail. It feels awful. No one wants to make a mistake. So that combination of like trying to avoid the uncomfortable feelings that come with failing, and that sort of we'll talk about in a second, like the self-criticism that comes with that. So if you have this sort of combination of like setting standards that are always just a little bit higher, so always just out of reach, and then being really worried about failing, you're kind of setting yourself up for a really hard time, aren't you? You're setting yourself up to feel terrible about yourself a lot of the time. And that third part is then, of course, if I do fail because I can never reach those standards, so I'm probably setting myself up to fail, then I'm going to beat myself up So that's self-criticism. And so those are the sort of three big ones in terms of those underlying processes that I think are driving perfectionism, seem to resonate for a lot of folks. And then, of course, well, no one wants to feel like criticize themselves. No one wants to feel that sort of like I feel like a sick feeling, like I've failed or I've made a mistake. So we do a whole bunch of stuff to try and get away from that. You know, like what Emily Sandoz would say is like running, fighting and hiding from the things that we dislike. So working harder, checking at work more, striving to do like work longer hours or, yeah, all those kinds of things. Or completely like opting out, I can't do this, or procrastinating. So sort of can go either way. And all of those things are designed to protect you from feeling like a failure. And then the fifth process that I talk about is really just the outcome of that. It's not so much the outcome of the high standards, the fear of failure, the uncomfortable feelings that come with that and self-criticism. It's all the things you're doing to try and avoid it. That's what causes you problems. That's where you're working late and you're getting to burnout, or where you're opting out of a whole bunch of stuff and life is getting small and, you know, you're getting further away from the things that are important to you. So that's the sort of fifth process, is really the consequences of all of that. So, yeah, I think, I mean, it resonates for me. It's, I think it fits with an ACT model to sort of think of it that way, as at the heart of it is that experiential avoidance. And so there's a lot that we can do with ACT to address that, I think, and make people's lives better.
Wow, so much of what you're saying resonates, especially at earlier stages of my life. Like before we started recording, we were talking about music and my guitars in here. And that was such a big part of my relationship to music in the early stages of writing songs and recording things and keep pushing the bar on how much more and more time to spend editing the song or keep making it better, or the intense self-criticism and difficult feelings that show up when I would perform live and make mistakes, or how long I avoided performing live to try to get away from that feeling. So much just was, I was sort of tracking everything you were saying with that one area of my life when I was younger.
Yeah. I mean, you can see how perfectionism is so woven into that performance anxiety that musicians can get. Like, it's not a practiced it, but it's not perfect, or what will people say if I make a mistake? And that real self-focus, it's so common in performing artists. I take my hat off to you. It sounds like you went through a whole bunch of different phases of like struggling with that. And it's so tightly interwoven with anxiety, perfectionism too, that running, fighting and hiding.
Yes. Yeah, but it's really cool now to be pretty much on the other side of that with music in particular, and to have like to be able to zoom out and see where I was and how you can move through that in such a more flexible and workable way. So now when I work with clients and they're at some stage I was at one point, there's so much more compassion and understanding and insight into what they're going through and where they can end up.
Do you mind if I ask you a question then, Tom? Because I'm curious, and it sounds like that you are able to apply ACT to your, you know, your music, to your performance and enjoyment of music. Was that a conscious decision that you did, or sort of something that you sort of stumbled onto in a way? Like, how did that work out?
I think it was conscious and unconscious of just the underlying value and yearning to write songs and perform and do that sort of anchored me through all of the distress that came with it, where then through actually playing live and writing songs and showing people, it sort of naturally loosened up all of those tight knots, you know, sort of happened through experience. Yeah.
Wow, and it's a beautiful example to be able to give your clients, or to draw from yourself, because you have this is this process that was really tightening up around these standards you were setting for yourself around what your music needed to be and how you needed to be as a musician. And then you're able to, it sounds like, really connect with your values around that and make difficult, you know, make decisions to do what's important in the presence of that discomfort, which ultimately is what we're teaching people to do in ACT, isn't it, really?
Yes. So it's really cool to be able to map the ACT processes onto what I went through without knowing it was ACT. I mean, I was really into mindfulness and meditation and things at the time. So that's a big part of ACT. And so, but yeah, it's just really cool now to see where I can be with music and letting myself have first drafts when I write music instead of that intense pressure I would put myself for the first draft of everything being as good as it could be, or going into a performance and knowing there's going to be mistakes and that's part of the process. So there's all these things on the other side that have just made it so much looser and forgiving and enjoyable when I'm in this area of my life.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. Like the writing that I've been doing has then brought me into contact with a whole bunch of things that I've never done before. So less than a year ago, I'd never recorded a podcast, never been invited onto a podcast before. I'd never written a blog, or an ebook or anything like that. I tell you what still absolutely sends me into terrors is writing newsletters. I just keep procrastinating on that one because I feel this immense responsibility not to irritate people, even though that they have signed up for this, you know, for me to give them an update and they're wanting to know when the training is on or something like that. I'm still like, oh, but the email will be annoying and I can't, you know. But I was really nervous about my first podcast that I recorded and I leant into that, you know, that kind of, I actually really enjoy, I look forward to these, it's like conversations and learning about other people's experience and understanding of this. Like I just now can just like, I enjoy just sitting and having a chat. I'm sitting here, I'm sipping my cup of tea, which is rapidly going cold, and enjoying the conversation. But the first time, you know, I had notes about what I wanted to talk about and, you know, maybe I needed a bit of prep. I tried to wing it. Like I did wing it and it wasn't scripted, but it's definitely got a lot easier. And the anxiety has come down. You know, that. But you're leaning into it was important, right? It was important to me to be able to do this. And I was like this with, gosh, when I was doing public, if I'd ever had to do public speaking at school or when I was at uni, I was like sweaty palms, shaking, like heart racing, like full-blown anxiety to do those. And now it's like, what do you need me to do? Okay. But it was because it was important to me that I sort of decided I would try and get good at it, but also enjoy it as well.
Yeah. How is it? I'm so curious because writing is so difficult for me because of how much these processes can interfere because there's so much time to stop and edit and redo things. And so you wrote a book, which is awesome. If you want to, like, you could even share the title of your book and for people to know. And what was it like writing a book when it comes to your own challenges with this stuff?
Well, in Australia, you would say it was hard yakka. I don't know if you use that phrase. It was hard, hard work. Because I have a really, I've always wanted to write a book. My mum wrote books. My brother wrote books, like all sort of technical, like nonfiction books. And I always just wanted to write a book, and I'd sort of parked that whole dream, you know, in a way, because every time I went to sit and write something, this inner critic would come out, and I'm not joking, and I'm just going to do minor swearing here, it would just sit there all day when I was writing and go, this is shit, this is shit, this is shit, this is shit, all day, this is shit, well, this is shit, no one's going to like this, no one's going to want to read this, all your colleagues are going to think this is total BS. This is shit, this is shit, this is shit. And just all day, like it had, there were some days where that was just so relentless. And I'd come away exhausted and drained. And occasionally I would go, right, I can't do anymore, and I'd leave. But I kept coming back at it. I mean, it did get easier with time, but that critic was absolutely relentless during the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be honest with you, still now, occasionally people send me a message saying, oh, I'm really enjoying, you know, chapter 6 of your book, which is one of my favorites. So, and I'm like, oh, so it isn't total rubbish. And it's like, there it is again. There's my critic again. I can't believe it. Like, it's done. It's out there. It was quite, when it launched, so it's the ACT Workbook for Perfectionism, and it's out with New Harbinger. And it came out on the 1st of December last year. And I think I was quite anxious that whole period of that, and just like, again, out on the edge of my comfort zone, recording podcasts, doing writing, and so constantly stretching out of my comfort zone, and the critic was there, people aren't going to like it. You know, if one of these experts picks it up and reads it, they're going to realize that it's really a whole crock of shit. So thank you, critic, for that. That doubt's still there, Tom. Like, I can't tell you, like, that it's gone. I'm just trying to get on with it in the presence of that ongoing conversation that I have in my head.
Yes. Well, there's sort of an awareness that you can hold where you see that strong inner critic as part of the process of doing something that's outside of your comfort zone and important to you rather than a problem, right? You sort of just, like, maybe in the moment it can really jerk you around, but from a deeper part of us, we can see that that's just a natural outflowing of really caring about something and having high standards. And you can sort of build a familiarity with it.
Yeah, I think I like to sort of think of it. So in the book, we talk about it as being the passenger. The passengers in the bus is a really well-loved ACT metaphor, and I've sort of taken it. And I use it a lot in therapy with clients. So I just sort of wrote it out how I would say it with a client, and made it, you know, a bit interactive with questions and things like that. We talk about it as that kind of passenger on the bus. There's this inner self-perfectionistic self-critic, you can call it what you like, that's essentially it, and how it's never going to get off because it's been learned, you know, over time, it's been added to, and we can't ever unlearn. I meet a lot of clients who say straight up to me, I want to stop criticizing myself. I guess, how do I do that? I'm like, you know, this passenger's not getting ever getting off the bus. So, you know, and that does suck, but, you know, it's because learning only ever goes in one direction. So what we need to do is learn some different ways of responding to it, you know, a whole new way of responding to that, and can soften the way we feel about that passenger too, because, as you said, it has a good intention for you. It's part of you. It's developed for a reason. It wants something from you. And in perfectionism, I usually find it's one of two things, and often both. It wants you to do well. Like, it wants you to do, like, either perform well or, you know, meet, like, have really good outcomes in life, like have a good life. So just sort of do well. And it wants to keep you safe as well. So it wants to keep you safe from being hurt or embarrassed or rejected. So it's trying to protect you. So if you can start to see that voice there as something that is trying to help, but I think Russ Harris would say is the world's worst motivational speaker, you know, like it's one of his, I think. It's like, it's just going about it in like completely the wrong way.
Yes.
And really quite, can be very mean, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, this can be a very nasty voice. But it's trying to keep you safe. It's trying to protect you. So can we sort of let it be there and still drive the bus down the road to that future that is important to you? For you, that included music. You know, you didn't want to quit music because you loved it and it was part of what you wanted to do with your life. It was really valued. You know, for me, it was writing and many other things, you know, these sort of things that are hard. And they're valued. So I learned to listen to that voice and say, here it is. It's telling me this is shit. I don't always quite know what to do about it. Like, I'm like, okay, there it is again. No, everyone's going to think this is rubbish. Thanks so much. And I just keep going anyway. So a bit like you.
Yeah. Well, it's a much better option than staying at the bus station, and park.
Exactly. Or off-roading or going backwards. Yeah. Like some people, I ask people all the time, like, what's happening to your bus? Well, there's three different ways people can tend to broadly respond to their passengers. The first way is to just believe whatever it says. So when it says this is rubbish or you can't do this or you're never going to be good enough or may as well give up now, like the very defeating things that critical passengers can say, do you believe it? A lot of people do. Yeah. Automatically, they just assume because they think it that they should then believe it. So how much progress is your boss making when you're just believing that and doing what it says? Because ultimately, you're just trying to keep it quiet. Yeah, okay, I won't go to the gig, okay, I won't write today. It's just not going to be any good. So do you just believe it? What happens to the bus? The bus is going nowhere. Is it stuck in a ditch or it's just, completely idling on the spot, stuck in neutral? Another way people respond to their passengers is to argue with it. Like get into a fight. But the first thing, in order to fight with your passenger, the first thing you need to do is take your hands off the wheel, lift up your fists, get into a debate, try and defeat it with logic. But then you're not even looking at the road. You're putting all your energy into arguing with yourself, essentially. And that gets you nowhere. The third way, and I take this from Lisa Coyne, this idea of white knuckling. I don't know if you're familiar with the white knuckling. Yeah, so that, if you're going over the top of a roller coaster and you're gripping on, you get white knuckles. It's that kind of, right, I'm going to force my way down the road. I'm going to do all the things or everything I should be doing, but just shut up, passenger, just push you to one side so I can get down the road here. And you get down the road slowly maybe, but it's exhausting. Just totally exhausting. And that's where I meet a lot of people. I'm a busy professional, or I'm going to uni, I'm studying really hard, but it's just relentless, this talking, and I can't get it to be quiet, and I'm just forcing myself to do all these things that I find really hard, and I'm like, oh, it's just so exhausting. So we need to get to a point, and that's where your mindfulness is so important, of mindful acceptance, that kind of detached, diffused, there it is again. Thank you, passenger. You're like, gotcha, thanks, yep, I hear you. And, even though you're saying all those things, I'm going to drive. I'm going to get on with what's important to me. And takes a lot of practice to be able to do that.
Something you were saying earlier about how we can view that inner critic as its function on one level is to try to protect us, because our brains don't really distinguish between social or physical threats or being rejected or making mistakes at work, and I think that ties in nicely with something you talk about in the book that was important to you and early on in your understanding of this, is the role of self-compassion. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about how self-compassion comes into this?
Yeah, well, I love compassion-focused therapy's approach, but I also think compassion is infused into every aspect of ACT as well, because there's this idea of what you're doing makes sense. It makes perfect sense. If you think of the function of your behavior, that functional approach that we have in ACT of what is the function of this behavior in this context, it takes all of the intention, the bad intentions and the agendas out of it. It's just behavior, which I think opens up the door for self-compassion. So when I talk to clients about like all the extra time they're spending at work, checking over their work and how they're getting behind, it's like, well, of course you'd be doing that. That makes perfect sense. No one wants to make a fool of themselves, like that's if that's what you're worried about, or no one wants to be judged as hopeless by their boss. Like it makes perfect sense to want to avoid feeling that way. And I think just right there, that's this opening for compassion, isn't it? It's like you're not doing this to make problems for yourself. It's not, because a lot of people, you know, get really stuck into beating themselves up because they're beating themselves up, like this sort of like, oh, I should be kinder to myself, you know, and why am I criticizing myself? And yes. I just, you know, like getting the boot in when they're down. And I think it's just like, okay, what you're doing makes perfect sense would be something I would commonly say in therapy. And it's also causing you some problems as well. Like, so maybe even though it makes sense, maybe there's another way, you know, there's something else that you could be doing here, you know, that it might be hard in the short term, but in the long term is going to get you down the road to what's important to you, get you towards what you value. And it might be hard. It might mean showing up for things that you've been avoiding for a long time. Maybe not doing a whole bunch of things that you've been doing to try and make yourself feel better. I know that you can do that, right? You can do all sorts of hard things. And it's easier. I teach a little bit of self-compassion as part of my work. I don't claim to be an expert in there. I've probably got a little bit of an imposter syndrome thing going on with compassion-focused therapy. But I try and just open the door for people to sort of step into just seeing themselves more, like their behavior functionally, and their open this idea that we don't actually have to be hard on ourselves to be motivated, to be successful. But there's another way. I still slip into it, Tom, honestly. I slip into criticizing myself way too often. I wish I could do it like too often. It just is what it is. I just heard a judgment in there, so I'm going to wind that one back and just say I still often slip into criticizing myself and judging myself. And I still can do a whole bunch of stuff that's hard. But that is important to me. So, yeah, I'm trying to practice self-compassion myself all the time. I don't need to criticize myself to motivate myself. I can say, hey, you know, this is hard. You keep going. You can do this. Just stick at it. I can speak to myself with a much more encouraging voice.
To sort of add maybe a little bit better motivational interviewer. Motivational speaker than the one that shows up by default.
Yeah. I love the two teachers metaphor. I don't know if you've got to that. I did write it out as well in the book. And I think that's one of the reasons why chapters 6, 7, and 8 are my favorites. And I know you shouldn't have favorites, but they absolutely are. The two teachers metaphor. Do you want me to go through what that is? Do you think your listeners would find that?
Yeah, I'd love that.
Cool.
Yeah.
So the two teachers metaphor, it goes like this. Imagine that you had a child just, you know, the age, just starting school, sort of 4 or 5. They're a normally developing child, so maybe they're having a little trouble sitting down for a long time. Just start getting started on their reading, their writing, their numeracies, and maybe struggling with some bits of that. And they're just starting out on their journey through school. And they have two teachers. Now, the first teacher notices that your child is struggling, comes over to them and says, you should be doing better at this by now. Like, I've showed this to you already. Everyone else seems to understand this. What's going wrong? Why can't you get this right? You know, you need to work harder at this. Oh, I feel a bit sick whenever I say that teacher. That's the first teacher. Imagine having a teacher speak to your child like that. And yet we know what happens, right? And then they have a second teacher as well, and that teacher is completely different. That teacher comes up to your child, maybe sort of sits down next to them and says, hey, I can see you're really struggling with this. Do you want to show me what you're finding hard? Let's do a few more before we go out and play. Let's see if we can go through this together. Tom, which teacher would you prefer for your child?
The second one.
Clearly, right? The second one. Which one do you think would help them learn and grow as a little human, you know? The first one or the second one?
The second one.
Yeah. So which of those sounds more like your inner critic? Which one sounds more like the way you speak to yourself? The first one or the second one?
Depends on the day.
Yeah. Right. Right. So most of my clients would say just burst into laughter or at that point go, yeah, the first one, right? I seem to think that what other people need is completely different to what I need. And yet, in that, even in that second teacher, there were all the elements there that child sort of needed to learn. There was a warm, compassionate approach. There was a motivation to help. And that teacher still held the child accountable, right? Like, let's do a few more before you go out and play. So there was still like an accountability to do the work in that second teacher as well. And yet we feel like we have to be mean to ourselves and motivate ourselves.
Yes. Now, the thing that maybe can be hard, difficult for clients sometimes with this, and I love that exercise. I'm going to steal it. I'm going to borrow it.
Go right ahead. It's not mine.
I'll give you. when we're clients, we have to do some work sometimes, is realizing that developing that second teacher doesn't mean the first teacher goes away.
No.
Or if the first teacher shows up while the second teacher is talking, that doesn't need to be a problem. Mm. They don't need to win. One doesn't need to win out the fight, that they can coexist.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, I guess there's probably a role sometimes for like, a little bit of first teacher, you know, occasionally you'll say like, just pull yourself together. You know, you might talk to yourself like that. And every now and again, I guess that kind of talking to yourself can be useful, right? This is a really personal story, but I do remember when I was giving birth to my second child, the midwife at one point came around to me and said, looked me in the eye and said, you need to pull yourself together. Right, that's probably too much information. Like, you can do this. You need to pull yourself together. And I was like, right. It was like a very direct message in it. And so maybe just every now and again, that is useful. I'll never forget her doing that.
Oh my God.
I know. most of the time, I would respond better if you say, "Come on, you can do this. Like, let's get going. Come on, you know, you've got this." I would respond better to that. And find that more motivating. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Some of those, you know, and this is where maybe the overlap with OCD can come in, you know, where this is really transdiagnostic, though, is like some of those first teacher thoughts are just intrusive and repetitive and so ingrained that it's not even there's not really any conscious control over like thinking those kinds of thoughts. They just pop up so intensely for people.
Yeah. Sometimes they sound a lot like someone in your life, a parent or a bully at school. The issue is that person is not the one saying it anymore. It's you saying it to you. And it's so automatic. Yes, you're right. Well, we don't have a lot of control really over our thinking at all, do we? I mean, we can slow it down. We can practice mindfulness. We're not really controlling our thinking so much. It's just maybe creating a bit of space or a pause because bang, you know, our thoughts will come back. That's why I think the approach that, you know, we're talking about with perfectionism, that's probably where I think it differs from that sort of CBT approach and I've got those books and protocols. Is they do in those spend a lot of time I guess, disputing the thinking around the standards, like the irrational kind of standards. And I treat OCD and eating disorders are probably my two kind of biggest client groups. So, and I see it in both, like there's no point arguing with this obsession. Like, it doesn't follow logical rules that I need to get an A on every assignment ever. Isn't a logical thing. Like, and I'm not into wasting my time in therapy. I'll tell clients, I'm not going to try and change your standards here. Like, I'm not going to tell you you have to lower your standards because I don't think you'd want to be honest, and I'm not going to waste my time. But I do think maybe you can be maybe more flexible in the way that you approach them. And I just do wonder if you know, we could practice some flexibility in like how you move through life around these goals, that's going to make a big difference. And people are more open to that because most people think when they're in therapy and we're talking about perfectionism that I'm going to just tell them to lower their goals.
Yeah.
So I don't think necessarily in CBT that's necessarily the helpful piece. Perhaps out of that it's that their people are diffusing from those goals a little, saying, I see what I'm saying to myself. I can see it from a little bit of distance and that would be helpful. But perhaps not just trying to dispute it. Some of the research I've been reading recently has said that bit, it's the fear of failure that is the bigger thing to address. So and that's where you would use like an exposure-based approach, really.
Mm-hmm.
I get my poor clients, because there's a mischievous side to me. I'm like, hey, I'd really love it if you could, what about you could send a text message with a spelling mistake in it? And they're just like, oh, are you kidding? Yeah. Like face full. And then I see like a pause and then I can say, hang on, let me just clarify. And you can't send another text afterwards correcting that mistake, and you can't tell them that your therapist made you send it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like,
yeah.
Oh, so you have to send it like it was an actual mistake. I have watched people agonize for 20 minutes over. I'm like, I'd just like you to misspell your something like that, something that really does great with people. And
I do things like that too all the time. I have that mischievous side of me. I do a lot of exposure.
Great.
In the work that I do. I work a lot with OCD. And,
awesome.
I'll do little things like that too. Like invite clients that have very like perfectionistic, body standards or presentations to just like, let's go through session messing up your hair. Let's just like mess up our hair a little
bit. Yeah.
I would do it too if I had hair, but so there's ways to kind of do that and presenting it with that, little mischievous way where it's inclusive and you can make all these things a little bit lighter because you're sort of lightening that invitation, meeting their hardened, like, that could never happen. Yeah. There's like there's a mixture of those two things that can be really helpful to the person.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you could both take your jackets off and turn them inside out, or wear wear your jumpers inside out, that kind of thing. Or all those kinds of things are really fun to do. Just and noticing what shows up when you do it, right? Is
mm-hmm.
a lot of in a conversation, a lot of discomfort. A lot of that, because a lot of perfectionism really does seem linked to social embarrassment. I mean, we're social monkeys, right? We wouldn't want to all fit in with, in general, and be accepted. But for some people, that's become quite a worry, and that social anxiety is hugely related to perfectionism as well. So. Anything you can do that can cause something like that is kind of fun. I do see perfectionism as on that continuum. Like, it's obviously, I'd say almost everyone I've ever met who's got OCD is perfectionistic as well. I could think they just go together. But I do see sort of perfectionism and OCD sort of on a continuum, because if you, at the very severe end, you would just treat perfectionism as OCD. It's become that rigid. It's like that. Just write OCD or something. It has to be if it's not exactly like this, it's not okay. And I'm going to feel really uncomfortable, or something terrible is going to happen.
So,
I always encourage everyone to screen for OCD when you're seeing perfectionism, and to make sure, because of course we know that OCD gets missed so often. I've missed it in coffee for a long time. I've missed it.
Yes. Agreed. That's been really useful, getting a lot of training in that early in my career as a clinician to catch things early on and really help people, and after, especially after they've been through years of therapy where nobody has caught it. That's super common.
Yeah, I'm jealous of that, because I didn't get all that training. I've had to come back and really work hard on getting that kind of behavioral training. You can, if you trained in OCD, you can treat just about anything, I think. If you can treat OCD, you can, and you can use a combination of ACT and ERP with that, you can treat any anxiety disorder for a start. So
yes, oh, it fits so well in with the ACT model too. You know, it's they're so congruent with one another.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So something I was going to ask you about that I think is linked in with perfectionism, and it seems to be like indecisiveness and decision making is something that can be really challenging for folks, myself included.
Myself too.
Talk a little bit, if you're willing, talk a little bit about how that fits in with this.
Yeah, I've come to accept that it just takes me a little while to make decisions, so that's been helpful. You don't want to make a mistake, do you? And I do think we live in a very complex world with many different possible outcomes from our decisions that we can't always predict. So it's, any mistake is an opportunity to make a wrong one. Any decision, sorry, is an opportunity to make a wrong one. And so that can become quite paralyzing. Again, in OCD, but just in perfectionism itself. I don't want to make a decision where I can't perform at my best because of the situation, or someone's going to be disappointed, or I'm going to waste money or time probably even more so. And so, I will agonize over decisions. It's helped me to sort of accept that, what I also don't like is making a mistake where I have to change my decision. So I don't like that. So to pull the trigger on a big life decision means, can I actually do this? Will I be able to finish it? So I'll agonize over that. But I've also come to the point where I can go, okay, that's enough agonizing now. Let's just get on, with it. So, and not get into such a knot over that. I do think problems making decisions is really a really common problem in perfectionism. Yes.
And this can often come up relationally too, like both in super common with people in relationships, right? Of like picking the right person to be with or the right person to marry, like big life decisions like that, or even sort of being other focused with your perfectionistic standards, not only holding yourself to high standards, but people around you. And that can become really challenging.
Oh, that's absolutely destructive in relationships, isn't it? Of all kinds, not just like intimate relationships, but if you're holding your colleagues or your team to perfectionistic standards, it's really creates quite a toxic workplace and culture. And a sense of maybe bitterness and disappointment around, like, no one ever meets your standards, which is not nice to be around for your colleagues either. My husband works in leadership. He's a psychologist as well. Pity our children. So he works in leadership. He's keen to write a book on perfectionistic leadership, because he just sees it all the time. That sort of getting stuck and not just needing to be perfect yourself, but also needing others to be perfect can be something he's often working on with people in his work. to be more human, you know, to be more, I guess, fallible, but also bring your whole self to work rather than a perfect image or perfect performance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So both decision-making and that sort of idea of not just, so I focus mostly on what Hewitt and Fleck called self-oriented perfectionism, the standards you set for yourself. But there's other oriented perfectionism, which is the perfectionism you have for other people, but also they call it socially prescribed perfectionism. And I do work with, so that's, I just think of that as context, right? So if you work in an environment where perfection is expected in your job, and I've met people who say maybe work in legal or architecture or, you know, work where there's precision is involved in the work, that can be very hard standard. And if you work with a boss who does expect perfection, think about training in psychology, training, perfectionism is rewarded all the way through until you get to the end point and you're working with clients and then it doesn't work at all because clients don't behave in ways that are predictable and there's no perfection in therapy, and yet if it's a huge trigger for burnout, I think, for early career therapists. It's like, I need to do this job perfectly. There's just no such thing. Yes. That context that you're working in is something I work a lot with people around. Like, what can they influence in terms of their context, or how do they detach maybe from their context and set their own standards?
Yes. Well, that was a perfect segue into one of the last things I wanted to talk to you about that you touched on in the book. And you and I are both clinicians, and a lot of the folks who listen to this podcast are clinicians, I think, and or work with other people in some way. And this can be really difficult for us working with clients when we have these high standards, right? Like what you're saying, for each client's so different and at a different stage of their life, and we can really kind of overinflate our level of influence sometimes, or how much, like, wanting certain standards for a client's progress. So can you talk a little bit about how this can show up for us as therapists or human service workers, and any thoughts we have on that?
I do a lot of work with professionals around our own perfectionism. It shows up in many different aspects of our work, like trying to do perfect therapy, so maybe spending a lot of time preparing for sessions, and early career therapists more so, but still, or going the other way, and because we're not sure and we're anxious about doing a good job, not preparing at all again, so because then I'm just getting more worried if I don't want to confront this thing that I don't know how to do. Spending too long on your notes to try and get them. It's a big focus here in training, I don't know about in the US, about how, you know, make sure your notes are good because they can be subpoenaed by courts and, you know, your client could end up reading them, or, you know, and so you're writing notes for other audiences and rather than for your own understanding. So people spending an hour with the client and half an hour writing the notes, so that's just too long, and the burden of that is immense in terms of your well-being. I see it a lot in I offer consultations sometimes to other psychologists. I see it in going over time. I'm getting to the end of the session but wanting to make sure it's either like perfectly wrapped up or you've sort of demonstrated your value to them. So like, I just need to do a little bit more, another 5 or 10 minutes, it slips into maybe another 15 minutes because you're wanting to sort of either perfectly wrap up loose ends or demonstrate like that you've done a good job, maybe even more to yourself than anything. So, and that, you know, then you're running late or you're using up your breaks, and there's always a lot of pressure. There's been a lot of pressure over the last couple of years on therapists to see a lot of clients. There's been a lot of demand. I don't see that changing. So setting unrealistic standards of yourself to see more clients or to get more out of your day could be perfectionism. And if you're going over time with your sessions, then gosh, you know, you're just exhausted at the end of each day, the end of each week. So I think we really do have to work on our own perfectionistic standards. We see these people, what, once a week for an hour at most. I rarely would see people weekly, so once a fortnight or even once a month sometimes. And, yeah, it's a good conversation, but it's up to the client, isn't it, to make those changes ultimately. So I can influence, but I'm not there for all the rest of those hours that they have. So trying not to...
I always think about how... You know, when I look back at my own life journey at certain points when I was really stuck in something, there's nothing anybody could have said to me that would have rushed that process or like expedited it. And sometimes, you know, we meet clients at different stages of their journeys, and sometimes we want to push things forward at a pace that isn't where their journey is at. And that can be frustrating if we are uncomfortable with where they're at.
Yeah, just sitting with them in that decision that they're not ready to make. Do I stay? Do I go? You know, do I study? Do I not? Do I, you know, the big life decisions, do I take the next step in this relationship? Do I not? Sitting there with the, you know, the I don't know, that there's reasons for and against in that ambivalence, in that, that contemplation stage of change is really hard. And if you expect that you're going to move them faster than they're willing to move, it's not going to happen, is it? You just feel as stuck as the client. So I love to do that. I just sort of say, this is where you're at. This is the decision you're trying to make. Here it is, you know, like, and if you, you could stay in this space of not knowing what to do forever. It's not like there's, it's never going to get comfortable. There's never going to be a point where it's like, oh, I feel good about this decision now. I'm just going to get on with it. It's like that discomfort, that cognitive dissonance, that ambivalence, that's all going to stay whether you make the decision or not. So you, you choose, but I can't do this for you. Yeah.
Well, being mindful of time here, this was really great talking to you. It was so cool getting to know you a bit. And was there anything that you would have, you know, wanted to share, things we didn't get to?
Oh, no, I've really enjoyed this conversation, just sitting back and having a chat, really. I'm really appreciative that we got to talk a little bit about OCD, which is a, you know, an area of interest of mine as well, and that overlap. No, it's good. It's really great. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Well, cool. Maybe we can do it again one day.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Love to.
Well, would you want to share how people can connect with you? I know you have a website, and if you're on social media or anything.
Yeah. So a good way of connecting is just my website, jenniferkemp.com.au. You can find a whole bunch of stuff on there that's free to download. I've got an ebook on there called The Perfectionistic Helper. So that's designed for people like your listeners who may be struggling with perfectionism themselves, just an opportunity to sort of think through what this is and what are some of the ways I can address it. There's my book, obviously, which you put in the show notes and that kind of thing as well. So everything that I sort of come up with, I just post up on that site. So that's probably the best place to go. I just try and keep updating it. And every now and again, I even send a newsletter out. Even I'm so due for one every now and again. So let me just reassure any listeners that if you do sign up for my newsletter, you will not get bombarded with messages from me. That is unlikely. You're unlikely to get anything more than once a month from me. But I will try and keep people up to date with any new, like just to highlight if there's anything new I've posted on the website or any training I've got coming up in different locations, that kind of stuff. So I am running a bunch of trainings. I've got some coming up with one coming up with Praxis later in the year. Hasn't been launched yet, but that will be out. I've got one coming up. I don't know when this podcast is coming up, with the Southern Californian ACBS group. I'm doing a 2-hour training in May with them. So it's worth looking out for. So yeah, bunch of stuff. Oh. Yeah.
Well, very cool. Well, thank you so much again. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Hope to talk to you again soon.
You too. It's got me out of my mind. It's got me seeing trees breathe. It's got me learning how heaven and hell are both inside of me. It's got me feeling the love that I bottled so deep. When the entire world kept feeding on my greed. Never know, but I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul. Oh yes, I know. I'll never know, but I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul. Oh yes, I know. I'll never know, but I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul.